Okay, so so I guess you guys represent the hangers-on, which is I'm glad that it's actually a higher percentage of originals than I thought.
It's a scorpion.
Well, there are other seats. Let's continue talking about translation. I introduced you to ribosomes last time. We only got through a slide, but remember that ribosomes are modular, meaning that any small subunit within a cell can fit together with any large subunit. They don't stay together, and you won't see them together like you do in pictures in textbooks like this one, slide one or slide two. You don't see the two subunits together by themselves. They only come together after the messenger RNA has first bound to the small subunit, and then the large subunit comes along and clamps the messenger RNA between the two, basically. But it's useful to look at them together without anything else there, just for simplicity. And what we see here is that this happens to be a bacterial ribosome, which is why it's a 30S and a 50S subunit. Eukaryotes have different size subunits, but they really operate exactly the same way. So it doesn't matter that this happens to be a bacterial ribosome. The point is that in the ribosome, there are three slots, which notice are labeled as E, P, and A as we read from left to right. However, they operate in the reverse order. A operates first, then P, then E. And they are called this. Notice that the A slot is called the A slot because it is the place on the ribosome where an aminoacyl tRNA is able to come in and bind there temporarily. So what is an aminoacyl tRNA? It's simply a tRNA molecule that is carrying an amino acid. So a tRNA can exist in three forms. It can be a so-called uncharged tRNA, in which case it's just a tRNA molecule. It's not carrying anything. Or it can be charged, but there's two ways that it can be charged. Charge means that it's carrying at least one amino acid. If it's carrying exactly one amino acid, it's not only charged, it's called an aminoacyl tRNA. And that's what the A slot accepts. One at a time, an aminoacyl tRNA carrying its specific type of amino acid. There's only one connection point on a tRNA, so if it's carrying anything, it's going to be an amino acid at that tip of the tRNA, but it can be a string of multiple amino acids that it can be carrying instead of just one. And in that case, we don't call it an aminoacyl tRNA, we call it a peptidyl tRNA because there's peptide bonds between adjacent amino acids that it's carrying. All right, so those are the three possibilities. Well, the P slot in the middle gets its name because it is the binding site for a peptidyl tRNA. And the E is named for the exit. So the idea here is that one amino acid is brought in at a time, being carried by an aminoacyl tRNA, or being carried as part of an aminoacyl tRNA. That lands at the A slot. And then there's going to be a shift of the ribosome to the right, or of the messenger RNA to the left, however you want to think about it. And that's going to put that tRNA that landed in the A slot in the P slot. And it's going to leave that A slot opened up, where another aminoacyl tRNA will come in, bringing the next amino acid. And the amino acid that is being carried by the P slot one is hooked to the one being carried by the A slot one. And that turns it into, that forms a peptide bond. So, in other words, the strand gets longer and longer, and it's being carried at any given moment by the tRNA that happens to be in the P slot, which is because carrying those multiple amino acids qualifies that tRNA as a peptidal tRNA. All right? The P slot one is going to shift all of its amino acids to the amino acid being carried by the incoming aminoacyl tRNA. That's going to leave that tRNA uncharged because it got rid of all of its amino acids. And that's when it lands in the exit slot. An exit slot will receive the now uncharged tRNA that's already transferred its amino acid over, and that uncharged tRNA will exit from that exit slot. We're going to look at this again in a minute, but I just wanted to explain the names of the slots. Let's go to 3 and look at a tRNA molecule. Now, there are multiple kinds of tRNA molecules because it's really important for the information that's being conveyed in this whole process of protein synthesis to be maintained. You have to maintain the integrity of the information. All right, so that's why there was a strict correspondence between DNA originally in the gene and the messenger RNA that was produced by transcription. You didn't make just any messenger RNA because you had to have the information be maintained in order for this to work. So you make a specific messenger RNA based on strict complementarity, right? That maintains the integrity of the information. During translation, the information that is in the messenger RNA needs to be sure to be used correctly to string together the correct sequence of amino acids. And transfer RNA is the adapter molecule that maintains the integrity of the information, by which I mean that the tRNA molecule is the thing that actually reads the messenger RNA by virtue of complementarity between a part of that tRNA called the anticodon and the codon itself, which is on the messenger RNA. Messenger RNA is holding the information. Transfer RNA, by being complementary to a codon in the messenger RNA, ensures that information is intact. And it's able to ensure that the information is intact because a tRNA molecule with a certain anticodon corresponding to a messenger RNA codon can carry only the type of amino acid that corresponds in the genetic code to that codon. So there's not one kind of transfer RNA, there are many kinds. Remember, there are 64 codons, 61 of which are encoding amino acids, which is more than you need, right? That's the redundancy aspect of the genetic code. Well, there are TNAs for the different codons. But actually, there aren't as many tRNA types as there are amino acid specifying codons. So it's more than 20, but it's fewer than 61. All right, but there have to be multiple different kinds of tRNAs because each individual tRNA is allowed to carry only the kind of amino acid whose codon in the genetic code is complementary to that part of the transfer RNA that we call the anticodon, at the bottom of the cloverleaf pattern. All right, so these three nucleotides, read in the 3' to 5' direction, make up the anticodon. And that's because, remember, the genetic code is read in the 5' to 3' direction. That's the messenger RNA. The anticodon has to be antiparallel to that. So we read the anticodon in the 3' to 5' direction. The last time we looked at a tRNA molecule, it was shown the other way around for some reason. I don't know why the book chose to do that. It showed the carrying end, which is always the 3' end, the carrying end, the part that carries the amino acid. It was on the other side in that other figure, so don't be confused by that. But it's 3' here, 5' there, which will match up to 5' to 3' codon in the messenger RNA. Now, we've already talked about modification of RNA in general, including transfer RNA. In fact, that was the example I gave you. So that's why you have some things other than the normal A's, U's, C's, and G's in here. I've talked about the fact that some nucleotides get modified, including, for instance, this I, which is here, which is not one of the four major ones. That stands for inosine, which we'll talk more about. Anyway, that, remember, is the two-dimensional way of looking at it. It's not really its shape. It's the 3' end, though, of the tRNA that is able to form an ester bond, which is a covalent bond with the particular amino acid that tRNA is allowed to carry. So any given tRNA carries only one kind of amino acid. And that's why you need at least 20 of them. But you actually, you have more than 20 tRNAs. You just don't have all 61 possibilities. I'll explain why in a minute. So when you actually account for the three-dimensionality of it, it looks more like this, any one of these cartoons. And that's how they're usually depicted in this book. Okay, now to 4. Here we have inosine pairing going on the bottom. Well, there's on the top, before we get to the inosine pairing, let's look at this normal pairing. C and G you would expect to be together, right? But actually, guanine in a tRNA anticodon can also match up with uracil in the messenger RNA if it's in the third position. Now, the first two positions, meaning codon, you read the codon from 5' to 3', the first and second position in the codon have to match up with perfect complementarity rules to the transfer RNA anticodon in those two positions. But the third position in the codon has what we call wobble. And actually, this accounts for... it doesn't actually account for the redundancy, but it's related to the redundancy. The third position is a little more forgiving. You don't have to have things perfect. For instance, like I said, uracil in the messenger RNA, a U, which would normally call for what? An A, can also bind to guanine if it's the third position only. And what you see on the bottom is that a different kind of base that we're not used to talking about, you usually are thinking about the five main bases, right? The four that DNA use, the four that RNA uses, which is five total among those two. Well, those aren't the only bases possible. Inosine is a base that's used in tRNA. That's part of that post-transcriptional processing. When you first make the tRNA, it gets processed various ways. One of those ways is to replace whatever the base was with inosine in that third position. And inosine is more versatile. It can bind, as you see, to cytosine, to uracil, or to adenine. And that's why it's called the wobble, because you don't have to have a perfect fit between anticodon and codon. You only do in the first two slots, and then the third slot could be one of several possibilities. Well, we see those possibilities in slide 5. Notice that the table says this is the third position only, and the third position is the one that's highlighted on the top. That's the only one that has the wobble. You have to have strict complementarity for the first two. But if the, as you see here in the table, if the third one is any one of these, then the anticodon could be any of these corresponding ones, and it will work. All right? What this means, this is why you don't have to have 61 different kinds of tRNA. You have to have 20 at least so that all of the 20 amino acids can get carried by tRNA. But you don't have to have all 61 because wobble means that the same tRNA could match up to more than one codon. Right? Importantly, though, if that happens, if you have one tRNA that can match up to two or more different codons, those two or more different codons have to be specifying the same amino acid because that tRNA is allowed to carry only one kind of amino acid. That's what ensures that the information's integrity is kept intact. You see what I'm saying there? So if you have one tRNA that can recognize any of several codons, when you look those codons up in the genetic code, they all correspond to the same amino acid. And therefore, that one amino acid that that type of tRNA is able to carry is the correct one in all those cases of codons. Okay. That's important for the non-ambiguity aspect of the genetic code. Let's go to 6 and talk about charging a tRNA. Charging a tRNA means connecting an amino acid to it, or a string of amino acids. Another name for charging a tRNA is aminoacylation. To put on an amino acid, to hook an amino acid onto something, and it is to aminoacylate that thing. All right. So we're forming an aminoacyl tRNA. That's why the verb makes sense. The noun aminoacylation. Just as there needs to be different kinds of tRNA, each one of which carries its particular type of amino acid, you also need to have different enzymes in charge of aminoacylating those different kinds of tRNAs. So, in general, an enzyme whose job it is to aminoacylate a tRNA or to charge a tRNA is called an aminoacyl tRNA synthetase. That's what this kind of embryo-looking purple thing is. It's an aminoacyl tRNA synthetase. That's an enzyme, right? It gets its name from the fact that it synthesizes or brings together a tRNA that's uncharged and the amino acid the particular kind of amino acid that that type of tRNA is allowed to carry, namely that corresponds to its codon, to its anticodon. All right, so that's why you need different enzymes. Each aminoacyl tRNA synthetase is able to work with just one type of tRNA and just its amino acid that it's allowed to carry. So there are 20 different kinds of these, at least, to do the job, to make sure that the information is maintained. Let's look at what happens here, though. An amino acid represented by the purple circle or sphere at the top needs to come in, but ATP is coming in as well. Now, why do you need ATP? Because this is an expensive process. Building a protein is expensive for various reasons. There's many steps that require an energy-carrying molecule. It's not always ATP, but in this case, to charge a tRNA with an amino acid is to bring two things together to build a bigger thing, right? Well, you would expect that to be an endergonic process. So that's why ATP is coming in as a second substrate along with that particular kind of amino acid. Now, the amino acid isn't specified here, but if you were to specify it, then only a certain, the correct kind of amino acyl tRNA synthetase that's correct for that amino acid would work. So there are different synthetases for each of the amino acids. All right, so the ATP and the amino acid come in so that the amino acid can get charged, can get energized by this, by the hydrolysis of the ATP molecule. And so notice that it's a hydrolysis not by just splitting off one phosphate, which is the usual case. Two phosphates get split off. Pyrophosphate gets cleaved off of the ATP, leaving AMP, right? That allows for a connection between AMP, a temporary connection between AMP and the amino acid. Now, this happens before the tRNA comes into its own part of the active site on that same enzyme. But after that's done, then tRNA is allowed to come in, and the tRNA displaces the ADP or AMP. All right, so the AMP gets knocked off. The tRNA takes its place and the enzyme catalyzes the formation of the ester bond at that 3' end of the tRNA. So there's a pool of uncharged TNAs in the cell all the time. And they're, as far as translation is concerned, they're worthless until they find their correct kind of amino acyl tRNA synthetase and get charged with their particular kind of amino acid. Only then can they help out in the process of translation. All right? So the uncharged ones are there because, as we'll see, they're going to drop their amino acids off at the ribosome and become uncharged again. Well, they have to then go get recharged by their own kind of synthetase. Now, tRNAs are very similar to each other three-dimensionally, but each individual synthetase version allows only that one kind of tRNA in, the one that is appropriate to carry that kind of amino acid. Well, as you might expect, the way that it ensures that just the right tRNA is brought into the active site is that there is a correspondence between the anticodon and the active site of the enzyme. That's part of it. It's not just the anticodon, though. The anticodon is read by the enzyme, in a sense, and also a different part of the tRNA. So there's two places at least that actually have to be just right, ensuring that the right kind of tRNA comes in. Now, once the ester bond is formed between the amino acid and the tRNA, you officially have an amino acyl tRNA at that point. A tRNA carrying just a single amino acid is an amino acyl tRNA. That ester bond is important because it is a high-energy bond. And so a lot of the energy that came from that ATP molecule originally is now in the form of that ester bond, which will be important for polymerization of the polypeptide. That energy is used to allow peptide bond formation when it gets time to take this thing to the ribosome and assemble the actual polypeptide one amino acid at a time. Okay, let's go to 7. The top messenger RNA is labeled as prokaryotic, bottom as eukaryotic. They differ, of course, various ways, but what they have in common is that there are untranslated regions at each end in any given messenger RNA, regardless of cell type. So there is what's called the 5' untranslated region, or UTR, and the 3' UTR. What comes between those is called the coding sequence, meaning that's where the codons are. All right? The untranslated region has nucleotides in it, of course, but we don't consider them in triplets. They aren't called codons because they're not going to be read by the ribosome, and they're not going to correspond to anticodons in tRNA. They are important, though, even though they're untranslated. They're important for allowing this messenger RNA to come together with the small ribosomal subunit, which is the initiation of translation. All right? Well, in a bacterial messenger RNA, within this 5' untranslated region, you find a sequence of nucleotides eponymously called the Shine-Dalgarno sequence. It can also be called the translation initiation sequence. That sequence is important in bacteria for there to be binding of this messenger RNA to the ribosome in such a way that the first codon, the start codon, which is AUG, is put just in the right position in the slots of the ribosome, namely in the P slot, as we'll see. Now, there is no Shine-Dalgarno sequence in eukaryotic cells, but the 5' cap, which I've already told you eukaryotic mature mRNA has as part of its post-transcriptional processing, that becomes important, kind of does the same thing that the Shine-Dalgarno sequence does. It allows for proper binding of messenger RNA to ribosome. It can also be called the translation initiation sequence. All right, now the coding sequence itself can be defined as monocistronic or polycistronic. The cistronic part of that word is C-I-S-T-R-O-N-I-C. Monocistronic means containing one gene's worth of information. It's not a gene, because the gene is the DNA, right? But the DNA, the gene in a DNA corresponds to one protein. We're talking about protein-coding genes. Therefore, if just one gene's worth of information is encoded in messenger RNA, we call that a monocistronic mRNA. In bacteria, many mRNAs are actually polycistronic. And we'll talk more about this in a different chapter, but what that means is that bacterial DNA is arranged in what are called operons. An operon is multiple genes worth of information, but they all get transcribed as one long messenger RNA, which will then lead to the production of multiple different proteins all at the same time. It makes sense to organize them this way because the different proteins that are encoded by one operon, multiple genes worth in that one operon, are all needed for a common purpose. Like they could all be enzymes of a particular pathway. So you either need them all at once or not any of them. And therefore it makes sense to process them all together. That's not the norm in eukaryotic organisms. They are mostly monocistronic, although there are some exceptions. There are some polycistronic eukaryotic RNAs as well. In any case, that's what's in this coding sequence. It could be one protein's worth of information or multiple polypeptides worth, depending on whether it's mono or polycistronic. Notice that the stop codon is listed as UAG, UAA, or UGA. Any one of those doesn't matter at all which of those three is used. They operate identically in the genetic code, but you have one of them, not all three of them. And that's true for either bacteria or prokaryotes or eukaryotes. No, it mostly is prokaryotes. But there are, well, I don't know whether we even use the word operon in eukaryotes, but there are a couple examples of polycistronic eukaryotic. Yes. All right, now to eight. Now we can finally talk about the actual translation process. And what you can see here in the gray shading is that there are three major steps to this: initiation, elongation, and termination. All right, so you have a small and a large subunit. They are not interacting yet. Like I said, they don't normally. You have the messenger RNA. It's in its mature form. It's ready to go. And you have a tRNA that is carrying the first amino acid. Well, the first tRNA to be used needs to be one that whose anticodon corresponds to the start codon. Because remember, the start codon does double duty in the genetic code. It signifies the start of translation, but it also codes for which amino acid? Methionine. Right, methionine. Although in bacteria, it actually, the first amino acid to be put down is a modified version of methionine called formal methionine. So there are two different kinds of methionine-carrying tRNAs in bacteria. One that is able to carry formal methionine, but actually what happens is that its aminoacyl tRNA synthetase charges it with methionine, normal methionine, and then that after that is charged, it gets modified into formal methionine. And that tRNA is going to be used only for the start codon, only for that first amino acid. The other kind of tRNA that's able to carry methionine in bacteria gets charged by a different aminoacyl tRNA synthetase, but it gets methionine put on it, and no modification occurs. So that's the tRNA that gets used every other time besides the start when AUG comes up as a codon. Because methionine, you know, it's not just at the beginning, it occurs throughout the sequence of a polypeptide also. All right? In eukaryotes and archaeans, it's not formal methionine, but ordinary methionine that gets put down first. And by the way, this is one of the various bits of evidence that points to us eukaryotes being more highly related to archaeans than either one is related to bacteria. I'm not sure I can say why, other than it worked. And, you know, it might not be the only possibility, but it worked for something that's so fundamental that, you know, like I was saying, the ribosomes are highly conserved, their genes are highly conserved, because if you start messing around with that, you affect so many things. Once something worked, it's very difficult to change it unless the random change that you present also happens to work, which is very unlikely. So it kind of just got fixed, probably, but why it was particularly AUG, I don't think that there's a good answer for that, or at least I don't know it. Okay, so since AUG is the only start codon, that means polypeptides start with either formal methionine or methionine, depending on the group of organisms we're talking about, as the first amino acid. But often, methionine is not really what the cell wants to have in that first position. It kind of just has to because AUG is the start codon. So in most cases, or at least a lot of cases, probably most, I don't know what the percentage is, that methionine that gets put on first after translation is done will get taken off. So just like there is post-transcriptional modification of RNA molecules, including messenger RNA in eukaryotes, there's also post-translational modification of polypeptides. Right? Once you assemble that sequence, that doesn't mean that's the final version of the protein. There can be a lot of modifications done, including taking that methionine off. But initiation refers to these various players in the game coming together. And that's where, if it's a bacterial ribosome and messenger RNA, that's where the Shine-Dalgarno sequence comes into play. If it's eukaryotic, that's where the 5' cap comes into play. But in either case, the messenger RNA lines up and binds temporarily to the small ribosomal subunit. And then, finally, the large subunit can come along and bind to the small subunit. That's when you finally see them together. But also, the tRNA that's carrying that methionine, or formal methionine, comes along and joins at the same time as part of initiation. And it, like I said before, gets positioned in the P slot, even though this is really not a peptidyl tRNA yet, right? That's the first time is a special case. Yes, it is an amino acyl tRNA, but we're putting it into the P slot. And that's it. The reason that the P slot will make sense is because from then on, all the other tRNAs that are going to be in that P slot are going to be carrying two or more amino acids and therefore will officially be peptidyl tRNAs. This is just an exception because you have to start with just one. All right, so in other words, the A slot is skipped in the initiation part of translation. The whole translation complex, which includes all these various molecules, come together in such a way that it's the P slot that's used first. Okay, elongation then refers to amino acyl tRNAs coming into the A slot one at a time. Now there's all kinds of different amino acyl tRNAs in a pool in the cell. And they might all try to get in there, but the only one that's allowed to get in there is the one whose anticodon is complementary to the codon that's in that A slot. That's what ensures the integrity of the information. All right? And because of the way the synthetases work, that kind of tRNA that's allowed in there, because of its complementarity of the anticodon, is carrying just the right kind of amino acid. All right, so each of these AAs is an amino acid. The first one is AA1. That was late. We've skipped some steps in the sequence. We've already added several. But this shows you that at each iteration of this cycle, a new amino acid comes in as an amino acyl tRNA molecule in the A slot. And then the amino acids that are being carried already by the one that's in the middle slot, those all get transferred to the amino acid being carried by the one in the A slot. And so, even though it is now in the A slot, it technically, momentarily, is a peptidyl tRNA that's in the A slot, right? But then everything shifts over. The ribosome shifts to the right, which means the tRNA that's carrying all these amino acids is now put into the P slot, which matches up with its name. It's a peptidyl tRNA at that point. The one that was carrying all the rest of the amino acids but already transferred it over to the other tRNA is now an uncharged tRNA. That's what gets put into the E slot and then ejected. Okay? It exits from the E slot as an uncharged tRNA. It's still a specific kind of tRNA, allowed to carry only its kind of amino acid, so it has to go find the particular type of amino acyl tRNA synthetase enzyme to charge it back with its correct amino acid. And it does so. All right? And that just continues for however many amino acids long the polypeptide is supposed to be, which depends on the length of the messenger RNA. Eventually, though, one of the three stop codons will come up at the A slot. And stop codons are not like the start codon. They do not also specify an amino acid. All they do is tell the thing to stop. In other words, when a stop codon does come up at the A slot, the last amino acid has already been added. No additional amino acids. And therefore, there is no tRNA that corresponds to any of the stop codons. Because tRNAs carry amino acids. I just told you that there's no more amino acid necessary. A different kind of molecule, not even a nucleic acid, comes in to the A slot when one of the stop codons is there. And that's called a release factor. A release factor is actually a protein. But it's able to fit in there and recognize the stop codon. And that is what causes disintegration of this entire translation complex. So, the messenger RNA is released, the two subunits separate from each other, the polypeptide is now on its own because that final connection between the last amino acid that was added and the tRNA that was last used is severed. That ester bond is severed. And now the polypeptide is on its own. All right? The whole thing disintegrates, and you've completed a polypeptide. This one ribosome has completed a polypeptide. But that's not to say that there is not another ribosome upstream of that same messenger RNA molecule, doing the same thing behind it, but just a little bit farther back in the process. So when I say that the translation complex disintegrates, that doesn't mean translation is necessarily done. Translation will continue for as long as you have all the raw materials in the form of amino acids and tRNAs, and for as long as the messenger RNA transcript is still intact. Now, this is an important point, because if messenger RNA were allowed to continue to exist forever once it's built, then you would turn a gene on, make a messenger RNA molecule, and then you continue making that protein for the rest of the cell's life. Right? That's not what you should be doing. You want to make the protein only when the protein's needed. So part of the control of protein synthesis is the degradation of messenger RNAs after they've been around for a while, and you've made several copies of that same protein by ribosomes coming down that same messenger RNA molecule. Well, it's time for you to turn that signal off, basically. Destroy the messenger RNA so that it can no longer lead to further protein synthesis. Now, of course, eventually you're going to need that protein again, but that's why you have the gene there as the book in the library that you can go back to and make a brand new messenger RNA that's identical to the one you just destroyed. But that way you're making the protein only when it's appropriate to make that protein, especially since it's not only is it expensive to make the protein, but something's going to happen in the cell because of the existence of that protein that you might not want to be happening at the moment. All right, let's go to 9. Here we're looking at the initiation being the initiation occurring with greater detail than we saw originally. And all of these IFs, those are just initiation factors. So still other kinds of proteins that are involved. Just like we had transcription factors, there are initiation factors as well that need to come together. And notice the use of GTP. So GTP is used to get that first formylmethionine-carrying tRNA. And this is a bacterial example. That's why it's formylmethionine. That's what the F stands for. Getting that first formylmethionine-carrying tRNA into place in the A slot and bringing everything together. That requires expenditure of a GTP. But that's just the beginning of the use of energy-carrying molecules, because every single additional ATP is going to require GTP expenditure as well, as we see in slide 10. So after the initiation has already occurred, you already have that one amino acid laid down, which is going to be methionine of some sort. Then it's time to start reading the other codons one at a time. That's elongation. So this slide 10 is all about elongation. The second amino acid comes in carried by its own GTP, I mean by its own tRNA. But GTP is involved because, by the way, the EFs, those are still other proteins. What do you suppose the E stands for? Elongation. There are initiation factors, IFs. There are also elongation factors. But anyway, GTP has to get used in order for this elongation step to happen. What I was talking about before as the high energy ester bond that the tRNA has with the amino acid that it's carrying, that actually gets spent in transferring the amino acid strand, however long it is up to that point, from the P slot tRNA to the A slot tRNA. All right, so that's what really transforms the peptidyl tRNA in the P slot into an uncharged tRNA, and it transforms the aminoacyl tRNA that's in the A slot into a peptidal tRNA for the moment. But then the shift will put things back to where they belong. The peptidal tRNA is now carrying a sequence one more amino acid long, and it's in the P slot. The uncharged one is in the E slot and gets ejected, and then that leaves open the A slot for the next codon to be read, allowing the correct kind of aminoacyl tRNA into to that slot. Unless, of course, it's a stop codon. Well, if it's a stop codon, we're no longer in elongation. Elongation is continuing to bring new amino acid coding codons into the A slot. So there's expenditure of GTP multiple places here, notice, and therefore a lot of energy gets used in building just one copy of a polypeptide, and typically you make many copies from just one mRNA, and typically you make multiple mRNAs from just one transcription event of the gene. So it's an amplification, right? One gene being read and making multiple transcripts, each of which can make multiple copies of the protein, ends up making quite a few proteins of the same type, but at great expense. All right, now to 11. Well, we've already looked at this in a different chapter, a different picture. This is a polyribosome. And so a polyribosome, recall, is a single messenger RNA molecule, a single transcript. In this case, it's the pink thing. Along with multiple ribosomes. And the polypeptides that they are building. Now, this is exactly the same code. This is just one messenger RNA. So there's only one instruction set here, one sequence of codons from the 5' to the 3' end, and that's the direction of travel of the ribosomes with respect to the messenger RNA. They start at the 5' end. That's why we read codons 5' to 3'. And then they travel from the 5' to the 3' end of the messenger RNA. And each time they shift by three nucleotides, or one codon, right? And that's because of what I've told you before. Organisms use a non-overlapping code, not an overlapping code. If they shift by just one nucleotide, that would be overlapping. That's not what happens, though. So it's a three-nucleotide shift each time there's movement of the ribosome with respect to the messenger RNA. And when that happens, you have one more round of elongation, which means that one more amino acid gets added to that polypeptide that's being carried by the peptidal tRNA associated with the ribosome. That's why you have different lengths of purple polypeptides coming off of these ribosomes. The one on the right end, toward the 3' end, that's been added longer. It started at the start codon, like all the ribosomes do, but it's been translating for longer, and therefore it's almost done. It's almost reached the stop codon, so that polypeptide is almost as long as it's going to be. The other ones are shorter because they're behind in the game. But the whole complex of this is called a polyribosome, and this goes with what I was just telling you about amplification. A single messenger RNA does not get used just once. It gets used multiple times for translation and will continue to be translated as long as it is allowed to exist. mRNAs don't last very long, though, just because that ensures that you're not wastefully making proteins that aren't needed anymore. They get degraded, but they get remade just by going back to the DNA drawing board and transcribing another version of that same messenger RNA. Now, in a bacterium, this polyribosome, recall, doesn't even have to have a completed messenger RNA yet. The messenger RNA here is a complete one. But if this were a bacterial cell, the 3' end might not even be done yet. As soon as you have enough messenger RNA hanging off of the transcription assembly line, a ribosome can start translating it right away. And that's why bacteria make their proteins quicker than we do. Not only that, but they don't have to mess around with getting their messenger RNA out of the nucleus into the cytoplasm. Plus, they don't have to mess around with editing their messenger RNA. No spliceosomes. So it's a slower process in eukaryotes than prokaryotes. All right, let's stop.